a business like Netflix or Amazon Prime. Businesses where once a customer engages with them, it becomes automatic and a part of their lifestyle from then on. But how do you build that forever transaction? I'm Robbie Kelman Baxter, and I have been studying subscription and membership models for nearly 20 years. In this podcast, my guests and I share the secrets and strategies of the membership economy. Join us for Subscription Stories, True Tales from the Trenches. One of the hottest growth areas for subscriptions is, wait for it, farming. Surprising? Maybe. But with small margins and big numbers, efficiency matters, and farming has become an increasingly high-tech, high-stakes business. Justin Rose is the president of Lifecycle Solutions, Supply Management, and Customer Success at John Deere, a 187-year-old company with revenues in 2023 of over $61 billion. You probably know them for their tractors, but they're investing heavily in subscriptions. In today's conversation, Justin and I talk candidly about why this manufacturing company has committed to reaching 10% of annual revenue in software subscriptions by the year 2030. The right and wrong way to accelerate transformation through acquisition, and how to maintain the trust of long-standing customers when you change the business model. Justin, welcome to the show.
Hey, Robbie. Thanks for having me. I'm excited for it.
So tell us a little bit about John Deere and subscriptions. I don't know if everybody listening knows your story. If you could just share a little bit of background, that would be really helpful for grounding everyone.
Yeah, I would love to. It's always great to tell the story of a business that maybe a lot of people don't think about as a subscription-oriented business. But given I'm guessing many of your subscribers don't know a lot about ag, I find the industry really, really fascinating. So I thought maybe I would give a little bit of a background. Technology is super prevalent, and I think sometimes that's underappreciated. But if I take one example, the job of planting, getting seeds in the ground, that seems pretty simple. But really what's happening is planters are running through bumpy, hilly fields, dusty, could be dry, could be wet. They're moving somewhere at or above 10 miles per hour, and they're putting down 720 seeds per second at exactly the right depth in the field. Now, that's all driven by a GPS signal with correction to get to a sub-inch level of accuracy, and it's instantly documented up to our cloud-based platform called Operations Center, which allows customers to be able to understand and analyze the operations. And it's sort of a joke on Twitter. Some of our customers say it's the only app they use more than X or Twitter today. So when I look at that, it's sort of amazing, actually. It blows me away, the technology at all different levels of the stack. And as crazy as that is, actually things are accelerating a lot. So we're bringing a lot more technology to more customers more quickly than we ever have before. But customers have two problems. One is they don't want to spend an enormous amount of money upfront to access that cutting edge technology. And the second issue is that there's always a bit of skepticism that it will work in their operations, in their field, for all the things that are unique about their farming. And so to overcome that, we've launched a new customer value delivery model that we call Solutions as a Service, also SaaS, easy to remember. And really the North Star of that is to try and accelerate the adoption of technology to unlock more value for our customers more rapidly. If it's okay, I'll give you one tangible example of how that works in practice. And so in 2019, we reorganized our business around what we call production systems. So that means customers that produce a certain type of crops. So think about corn or soybeans or sugar or cotton or high-value crops like vineyards and orchards. So each one of them, as you can imagine, has unique needs and specific things that they actually want to make their operation the most profitable. And the idea was we want to get really deep on those customers' economics to understand how we could help them become more profitable and productive and also more sustainable. And so if you think about corn production, the average in Iowa, which is basically the best farmland in the world, is about 200 bushels of corn per acre. Now, there's a contest, and there's a guy in Virginia, his name's David Hula. By the way, he's a John Deere customer, I should add. And he often wins. And the contest is to see who can get the most yield out of a single acre. Last year, he got, I think it's just over 620 bushels on a single acre. So The best farmland in the world, on average, is doing 200. But it's been proven that if you pay attention, if you actually monitor and measure each plant individually, you can triple that. So it's a huge amount of value to unlock. But the scale of agriculture makes that really hard. And this will probably come as a surprise to your listeners as well. But every year in the United States, there are 10 trillion, with a T, corn and soybean plants planted. 10 trillion. And so if you're trying to get to a world where you can optimize every plant at the scale of trillions, you really need cutting-edge technology. And we think that our recurring revenue and subscription business model is the perfect way to get that to market and help customers adopt it seamlessly.
Wow, kind of blowing my mind right now, thinking about trillions. When you talk about scale and in each one of those plants, I understand the problem, I think, at least a little better than I did a few minutes ago. I've seen posts and announcements that you're looking to have this be 10% of your revenue from these solutions as a service by 2030. And I'm wondering why you set that goal and the approach that you're planning to use to achieve it.
It's a great question. I would say we set that goal because we thought it was meaningful enough that we would have to commit as an organization to really do something different, but also achievable. And so it's in that perfect sweet spot where we can't just ignore it and then hope we kind of stumble into it at the end, but also it's not something that's totally pie in the sky. When we think about how we're going to get there, there's really, I would say, three different tranches of technology. One is things I described. Basic precision is what we would call it. It's connectivity of the machines to the cloud. It's the ability to do some basic tasks like drive the precisely same line down each field each year or between each pass. Next layer up, we call Sense and Act. And it's things like you may have seen See and Spray, which is a technology that uses computer vision and machine learning algorithms to look at each piece of foliage as it goes through the field and determine if it's a weed or if it's a plant. And then it only sprays the chemical on the weeds to kill the weeds. And that saves something like 70%, 60 to 70% of the herbicide that otherwise would be used. And then the top of the stack is autonomy. And we've committed to build out a fully autonomous corn production system. So what that means in layman's terms is that someone that wanted to use the most cutting-edge technology should be able by 2030 to farm corn using only autonomous equipment. And that we think is the real cutting edge. And then, of course, when you put those things together, the machines are connected.
Wait, can I just ask a clarifying question? Does that mean that if I'm growing corn, that I just put my John Deere tractor in the middle of a field and push a button and Netflix and chill? Or is there more involved?
You're pretty close. I think that it's interesting. I live in Austin, Texas, and we have a test farm down there. And I've taken a lot of customers and suppliers and, of course, other employees to the test farm. And the tractor goes out in the field and somebody hops out of it and jumps in a gator and drives back to the base. And then you make a big ceremony where you swipe right and the tractor starts going. And everyone stares at it very intently for the first 2 or 3 minutes. And then they start talking amongst each other and looking back every once in a while. And then after 5 or so minutes, they just don't even look at it anymore. It's quite boring, actually, right? I mean, the thing's just going up and down the rows by itself. So yeah, that's the idea. We had a customer, and you could think about what that means for people in a couple of different ways. One way is, of course, well, you can take the labor out. And in the farm economy in rural America, like everywhere, there's labor challenges. And so the idea of being able to, at key times during the season, have the equipment run autonomously if you need it to, so that you can get the job done at the right time, that's a huge value unlock itself. There's another example. A customer was telling me, at the end of the day, it's just the ability to have dinner with his family and feel like he doesn't have to be in the cab of the tractor for 18 hours during harvest or for a similar amount of time during planting. And so there's a real economic benefit, but also a real world just lifestyle type of benefit as well.
Yeah, it's interesting. So I think you said that the reason that you're offering this as a solution, as a service, as a subscription, rather than saying, buy this technology, buy this piece of software to go with your hardware, as you said, because of skepticism and because of cash flow.
Yep.
How has it been received by your customers?
It's three simple things. One, it's a lower upfront cost to access cutting-edge technology. Two, we are committed to them only going to pay for what they need or what they use in the field. And three, it's going to get better over time. And when you put it in those terms, it's almost their mindset shifts very quickly. And they start saying, well, if that's true, if that's really how you're going to do it, if it really is a lower upfront cost, they start to really quite like the idea. And in some ways, why wouldn't they? If I go back to the See & Spray example, so maybe just a touch more on the technology, think about a sprayer for those of your audience that maybe haven't seen this or don't have a visual, be a 120-foot wide boom, sometimes steel, sometimes carbon fiber on the back end, driving through a field. And if you think about it in a traditional way, spraying everything, just coating it with herbicides to kill weeds. The See & Spray sprayer has that same boom. It has 36 cameras mounted all across it. It's got 6 NVIDIA Jetson processors that sit there and run in real time, like in dozens of milliseconds. Look at what's in the field, ingest that image, use machine learning to decide if it's a weed or a plant, and then actuate the nozzle to spray in short bursts. And that technology, if you bundle all of that together and say, hey, you have to buy that once, it costs you over $250,000. Now, what we've done in this season is for our initial customers, we've offered at an upfront price of $25,000. And then you pay a subscription on top of that. And so for a customer, you put your customer hat on and say, well, I've lowered the barrier to trying it because $250,000 is a lot, but $25,000, I could jump in and just test that out. And then if I don't use it, if I find that it's not working, I'm not paying the subscription. I only pay the subscription when I'm actually using it on a pay-as-you-go model. And so it's quite an interesting way to break down those barriers that I talked about, that customers are skeptical about paying too much up front and ultimately it not working on their operations.
Yeah. Many other businesses that I've seen where they've been a going concern for a long time have established customer relationships for transactional-based products, products that they own, and then SaaS is introduced on top of it. One of the challenges faced is, do we sell it to our new customers? They're buying the new equipment and will layer in or introduce the concept of the software, or they already have products out in the market and we're going to layer this on and offer this as an upsell or as an additional option. Two things I really want to ask about this issue. One of them is, how did you think about where to launch this first and why? And then the second question I have, I'm sure you saw the whole BMW heated seats debacle, which everybody laughed about. I have to say this, everybody laughs about it. You know, BMW in one or two markets introduced an option where in the aftermarket, you could subscribe to heated seats if your car didn't already have them. So I live in Miami. I don't pay for heated seats when I buy the car new. I sell it to you. You're up in Michigan, let's say. You want heated seats. You can turn that on for the 6 months of the winter, see if you like it. Great flexibility, all the things you said, right? People hated it. And the reason I think is that they were used to owning things outright. And that was the relationship. They had a deeply established, strong relationship with BMW. And this was a new way of engaging. And so old product, new way of paying, existing customers, lots of issues. So I'd love to hear you just kind of riff on this topic of new versus existing customers and new versus existing offerings and how you manage that.
Yeah. As you said, to me, the big difference of what BMW did was they took something that everyone intuitively thinks they already have, a heated seat, horsepower. There's all kinds of derivatives of that type of model. And they tried to monetize it. And I think people just sort of rejected it. It felt like they were getting nickeled and dimed. Like, I bought this premium car, which in my mind's eye should have heated seats, right? Like, I mean, that's a little bit crazy. And now it doesn't, and they're asking me to pay more for that. And I think for us, the way we thought about it is, we are trying to put subscriptions around new cutting edge technology that's never been to the market before. And so again, if I use See & Spray or I use autonomy as examples, those are things that no customer is familiar with them or feels that it's part of what the equipment should already do. And in fact, on that See & Spray sprayer that I described, if the customer doesn't want to use the See & Spray technology, they can use the sprayer exactly as they always have. And they own it and it operates in exactly the same way it always had. And so we have the ability to communicate. We're making these large investments, drive cutting edge technology. Buying it once would look like this. Buying it from a subscription, a smaller one-time fee, and then ongoing subscription looks like this. And we can create price points in the market that helps customers understand the logic and candidly directs them to where we want them to actually ultimately engage with us.
Yeah, we do owe something to the BMW team. And it is true that in this kind of space, there aren't that many examples of how you do it. And sometimes you don't know what works or doesn't work until there's good logic to why you try it. I mean, same thing with New Coke, right? There was good logic. They weren't dumb people. They become the butt of a bunch of jokes, but I could see making the same mistake. Are there other companies or products or categories that you look at that provide you with insight, whether in your industry or more likely since you're a leader in your category in other areas?
Great question. When I think about where this type of model works and doesn't, in more of an industrial B2B space, a large piece of equipment type purchase, even automotive to some extent, I think it's got a much easier time working where there's a clear value proposition that you can link to the technology itself. And so I described for autonomy, of course, you get the labor at the time you need it. You save on hiring extra hand or extra labor. Plus, there's emotional and just lifestyle benefits. On See and Spray, it's probably even clearer. You finish spraying the field, and what used to use the entire tank, you now have 70% of the tank of chemicals left. And so you can just literally understand the math almost in real time about what that means for doing that. And so I think that industries where they can create and draw that clear cause and effect to, we're going to use the technology and it has an ROI. On the other hand, I've seen an automotive, for example, like BMW, but even beyond BMW, companies trying to build services businesses, recurring revenue businesses. And especially when the product is a B2C, like think about your personal car, it's just hard to think about what is that car going to do that's going to be better for me. Of course, I actually have dabbled in paying the subscription for Tesla's full self-driving, and that has a certain value. And by the way, if I did long drives and tired and need to work, I probably would pay for that all the time. But if I'm just daily commuting, it's tough a little bit to draw that value proposition out. So that's how we think about it in our industry. Now, we're blessed, of course, because it's kind of an easy answer that if you can create a clear delineation between do X and get Y, it makes the economics pretty straightforward and the value proposition to our customers straightforward. Obviously, not a lot of industries have that benefit. And so I think that that's where I tend to see more challenges.
Yeah. One that comes to mind for me, we had a guest last season from Samsara that does fleet management for cars and especially trucking. And what they did that I found really interesting is they took a step back and said, what is it that fleet owners struggle with? What are their goals? And what do they wish we could do for them? And kind of worked backwards from that perspective. Instead of getting better, I think sometimes I tell my clients, you can look with your microscope and do this incremental improvement on what you've always done. But there's also using the telescope and saying, okay, big picture, what's going on in the world? What are the problems that you're trying to solve? And if we were starting today, I think this is always a really good tool. If we were starting today with the same forever promise, so in your case, to help farmers be as productive as possible with as little time and expense as possible, what would we be building? What would we be doing? How would we think about it? Would we have ended up with the same machine or would we have done something different? And so if anybody's listening that's really thinking through this question, I think Samsara is another good episode to listen to. But I think what you're doing at John Deere, Justin, around the farmer's biggest challenges and thinking really differently about, like, that's not what you're known for historically, but saying this is the best way to solve the customer's problem on an ongoing basis.
Yeah. First of all, I think your Samsara example is a great one. I think that they have the ability to create a linkage to assets that are moving all around and then help optimize them. And that's really foundational when you're managing a fleet. There's other examples where companies are outfitting the equipment with all kinds of sensors and then able to understand predictively and preventatively when it may break or need to be serviced. And then on top of that, maybe selling a subscription to the parts or in the service. Obviously, I'm sure you're well aware of slightly derivative business model, but what all of the aircraft engine companies have done over time. And the thing, by the way, that I always found fascinating about that I learned as I studied them was when they pitch a new contract for an aircraft engine, they set a price of service that's below what they can do today. And they actually use all of the telematics and the diagnostics that they can pull off of the equipment to drive down their cost of service over time. And they're making a bet on themselves that by applying themselves, they can actually reduce the cost, extend the intervals between where it needs to be serviced, such that they can ultimately make money on that contract. And I love that mentality, just sort of betting on yourself and knowing that you have to be bold and aggressive in terms of how you're going to actually try to create the first hook into the business and then do everything you can as an enterprise to drive to make it more and more profitable for you over time.
Yeah, it's a great example. A couple of things I want to pull out for listeners. One of them is this idea of really moving to outcome-based pricing. I used to think when I was young and naive that subscriptions were the be-all, end-all, but over time, what I've really come to believe is that it's about aligning outcomes with pricing. And betting on yourself, as you describe it, is really about, I think, aligning the outcome, you know, saying, hey, we're going to be in this together. And if you don't get your outcome, we don't get our money. And that, first of all, I think is good business. It's good ethics. It's good karma. It's very attractive to businesses because they're being told, hey, you don't have to, or customers, you don't have to take the full risk. We're taking on a bigger piece of the risk because we're confident in your goals being achieved. But I also think it does something for the product team. And I'd love to kind of tee up this question for you about your internal teams as you make this transition to software being an increasing part of the overall business, which is a lot of times I see in going concerns when they introduce subscription offerings, it's sort of seen as a wraparound or an extra. And it's also seen as a, we'll just keep doing our core business the way we've always done it. And you guys can wrap it up, package it as you want, add other stuff, but it doesn't affect us. And I think your example of Boeing and the others, Rolls-Royce and the others that do power by the hour, one of the things that happens when you start offering something on subscription is it changes how you build the product. Newspapers have seen this, right? If you have subscriptions rather than ads that are driving your business, you need to have articles that people are willing to pay for rather than articles that people are willing to look at. Less Kim Kardashian and the royals, more bond trends and election results. And ultimately, I think subscriptions often come in, I always say off to the left, but eventually become core and then actually tail wagging the dog, change how business operates. I'm curious, at John Deere, what kind of impact you've seen from the increasing importance of software in the way the whole business is run and maybe even in the culture of what's been, you know, a longstanding successful organization.
Yeah, I love what you're saying. I think it's dead on. And if I, first of all, for those of you who don't know, John Deere is 187 years old. So, you know, it is one of the oldest public companies in the United States. And so there's a super strong legacy of just history with our customers, history in the places that we live and work that I think we're really proud of. But it is really challenging as well. And there have been examples of where we have tried to make big shifts. Again, I'll go back to See & Spray and say, where did that technology come from? We actually acquired a company called Blue River Technology back in, I think, 2017. And Blue River Technology was doing the same type of idea, using cameras to understand where there's weeds and then only spraying where the weeds were. But they were doing it at super low speeds in lettuce. And if you've ever seen lettuce, it's like one head of lettuce and then two open feet and another head of lettuce. So it's very proper, et cetera, et cetera. When we bought them, we gave them the challenge. We want to do this in corn. And, you know, if you juxtapose that with corn, you've got 9 feet tall, it's all overlapping. It's just a mess that you can't even walk through the rows once it's grown up to its full height. And so it was using their same fundamental technology, but it was a huge transformation for what they had to do as a business. And where I've seen a lot of companies go wrong, especially big companies, especially ones that are 100 years old or more that are really proud, is they get this beautiful new technology and then they try and integrate it. And they say, hey, you know what you guys need? Is you need some of our financial management practices or our HR overlay or our IT security standards, et cetera, et cetera. And I know not all of that's unavoidable, but at the end of the day, I think that that's the type of thing that tends to crush what made that thing special in the first place. And so we've tried to be really, really choiceful about where we integrate things versus where we don't, and how we continue to get the most out of, you know, the places that we've brought in technology from the outside. Now, that's half the story. The other half is just our internal work. And I couldn't agree more that changing how we're creating a business model is actually changing the product. We have examples of products that had very high adoption rates, i.e. someone had paid for them, but very low utilization. And historically, that wasn't really our problem anymore, right? Like if they didn't get the absolute max out of the piece of equipment, at the end of the day, like we had already sold it, it was sort of their job to do that, right? We could give them the tools, but we couldn't actually help them use it. We didn't try to help them use it. And so I would say 3 years ago, for most parts of our business, we didn't even look at utilization as a metric that we cared about. Now, as we've tied ourselves to subscriptions, as we've tied ourselves to some of the pay-as-you-go models that you were talking about, that is absolutely mission critical. It's not enough to ship something, even if we think it's great anymore. We have to get customers to try it, turn it on, see the value and help articulate it, and then ultimately close the loop and resubscribe or choose to use it the next season as well. And that cuts across everything we do, from how we think about instrumenting the technology to get data off, to the intervals at which we even review, like the progress of the technology, to how you feed back to the development cycle, to even how you budget things. Again, if I think about our business traditionally, it would be a big capital investment to build a new tractor, and then they would kind of tail off and you'd launch a tractor and you'd be good. And our business that we're in now, developing cutting edge software, riding on top of cutting edge hardware, you got to have continuous R&D pretty much in perpetuity if you want to have customers continue to use it.
Yeah, you highlighted a bunch of changes. I appreciate the comments on acquisition challenges and kind of blending two companies and two cultures. Also, you brought up the issues around the speed and iteration, continuous tinkering versus kind of a hit model where it's like you come out every few years with a big hit and jazz hands and you hope the critics love it because it's a big bet versus lots of little bets. And it is, I think, a very different way of doing business. I assume you're kind of the big champion within the leadership team of this piece of the business. How are you bringing in your colleagues to help them understand the changes that are required, not throwing the baby out with the bathwater, but using this to build a stronger business and better serve your farmer customers?
Yeah. First of all, I don't want to take too much credit for my colleagues. I think they are my boss, all my peers. They see the vision and they understand why we're trying to do this and they're bought into that. And so I think that we have a really strong foundation as a leadership team of alignment. Now, that's not to say there's not debates or points of friction, because the way we've organized ourselves, we have business units that own large agriculture, small agriculture, construction, and forestry operations. And so they're charged with driving to a P&L, to making quarterly results, to growing the business, to making it very, very profitable. And on top of that, we start moving to this more subscription model or recurring revenue model. And one of the hallmarks of that is, as I've mentioned several times, we've chosen to try to lower up the upfront barrier of cost for a customer to adopt and then drive it with utilization and or subscription annually and make it back over time. And the economics of that, when you look at the unit economics on a life cycle basis, are great. They'll be, I think, even better than our traditional, most successful businesses today. However, in year one, it's not great. In year two, it's typically not great. Year three, it's maybe break even, and so on. And so you actually are betting on a bunch of unknown factors. What will be the churn rate in our customer base? How much utilization will we actually get out of the technology? If we continue to improve it, will we have the ability to take a little price commensurate with more increased value over time? And all of that is spreadsheet math. But for them running their P&L, the reality is right now that hits them. That's an investment they have to make. And so we have this, I think, constructive tension in our organization where we're trying to understand how much confidence do we have in the out years? How confident are we in making significant investments now? Or how do we meter that in a way that works for our overall enterprise economics? And it's a really good discussion. I think it's to your point around how the business model has changed the product. I think it's also changed how we think about our business in a lot of ways, how we think about making those upfront investments and seeing that through and learning as we go and trying to drive different outcomes as best we can with customer success teams, leveraging technology to understand what's going on in real time.
Yeah, there's a concept we've talked about a few times on the podcast, concept of swallowing the fish, this idea that as you introduce subscription businesses, your costs go up as your profits, your revenues go down, and it kind of looks like a fish, and you kind of holding your breath until those two lines cross back in the revenue higher than costs area again. And that whole fish swallowing cycle takes, for a lot of organizations, 4 to 6 years or even more. And that there's an issue that I've seen with some organizations where they're all in at the beginning and they say they understand this, and you get into, let's say, year three, and you need short-term revenue. You need profit, and there's this pressure to slow down or cut corners on what is a really a long-term play.
We've talked about the fish a lot as a team. And ultimately, I think that to your point, you have to have the conviction to see these investments through, because you're wasting your time and your effort if you only go year one, year two, year three, and then you pull the ripcord and you try to get out. And the counterintuitive thing, maybe this is obvious to everyone, but it gets worse the more successful you are. So imagine you have an offer that takes off, and all of a sudden, that period of upfront investment where your revenues are coming down because you're moving more people to this new model and your costs are going up, the more units you sell in that world, actually the worse off it is. And so the worst case is that, from a financial standpoint, is that you are hugely successful. Now, the out years economics are amazing on that, and it's worth doing. And that's where we're spending a lot of our time trying to understand what we can absorb and then what we should expect. And then not just thinking about the overall portfolio, because that gets confusing. The piece of equipment that I sell with that model attached in 2024 versus 2025 versus 2026, when I group that all together, it gets messy because some are at different stages of their life cycle and in that fish journey. But if you look at the unit economics of just the 2024 vintage technology that we're putting in the field, how is that performing? Where is that on the life cycle? How does that compare to what's happening in 25 and 26? And you can start to extrapolate out and tell the story of investors, what your own employees, they're going to see over time with increasing confidence as you build scale.
Yeah, there's definitely a learning curve internally, but also, as you said, educating your board, educating your shareholders on how to look at numbers differently, how to look at unit economics, how to look at cohorts, right? Or you said vintages. Month one, what are people doing? What are people who are going to engage for the long term doing? And how is that different than the ones that don't? And what do we learn? And all of that, I think, is so important to invest in and to recognize before you go on this journey to swallow the fish, which is not my concept either, sadly. I wish I'd thought of it, but I think it's J.B. Wood at TSIA who came up with that idea. And we'll have an image in the show notes. But it's such a good thing to understand before you launch on this journey so that you're prepared, that you're really investing in the long term. And I actually think companies that have been around a long time, while change is hard, often they're the ones that are really good at doing this kind of massive change because they have such a long sight line, right? They're thinking about next gen. And I know my own experience has been sometimes working with closely held family owned businesses, not this case. Those are some of the companies that do the best with subscription because they're thinking about the next generation. Are we building a valuable business as opposed to, am I going to hit my number in the next 3 quarters before I move on to the next opportunity?
100% agree. I think we're going to attempt to do both, but we will see how we go and we'll continue to refine and learn over time.
Awesome. So you talk about SaaS. What about machine as a service?
Yeah. So part of, I think, success in this journey is also just about focus. And so we have a really big pipeline of technology that works in the value proposition that I've been describing, where it's seen as additive. There's no conflict with, hey, I already own this thing, or do I not own it? And so we've been focused on that. And we haven't actually started with machines as a service in our business. Now, it's interesting that you ask, because as I've visited dealers around the world, everywhere from North Dakota to India to Africa, there are some that are starting to dabble in this across different markets. And we're definitely keeping an eye on it. Now, the value proposition is maybe it's not all your machines as a service, but maybe it's a portion of your fleet. So if you think that I probably need 3.5 tractors for my operations, well, why not buy 3 and use that extra half capacity when you really need it, pay for it as a service, or all kinds of different models like that. And so it's something that's very interesting. I don't think we're not philosophically opposed to it. It's just not been our focus so far. So if our customers would tell us that they think that it's valuable for them, we would certainly look into it.
Awesome. I could keep going for hours with questions, and I hope maybe we can get you back on the show at some point in the future for the next chapter of the story. Before I let you go, though, I'm wondering if you're up for a speed round?
Yeah, let's do it. Fire away.
First subscription you ever had?
Probably a video game pass. I don't even remember what one. I played Nintendo back in the day, so I would guess it was something Nintendo related.
Awesome. We had EA. We had Mike Blank from Electronic Arts on the show to talk about video games a few seasons ago. It's one of my favorite clients and favorite topics. So
mine too. Mine too.
Okay. Favorite subscription today for personal use?
Favorite subscription today for personal use? I subscribe actually to supplement packs. And so I used to try and piece together different vitamins and supplements to take, and I found one that I actually really am bought into. And so they keep it easy for me. I get a little packet, a little sachet that I take, and I can carry them on the road with me. So that's probably my favorite.
Awesome. What's the story with the puppy in the tractor on your LinkedIn profile?
Yeah, so that's my dog, what I guess, fourth member of my family. So I have I have a 9-year-old and a 6-month-old little boy now. Then we have a adorable golden retriever puppy. So that's actually up at my family's lake home in Minnesota. It's the oldest piece of deer equipment we own. It's an old Gator work vehicle, and he just loves to run around in it and enjoys tooling around while he's not swimming in the lake. So thought it was a super cute picture and emblematic of kind of how I feel about the John Deere brand. It's something that we can all connect to that has depth and meaning to it. And so I thought it seemed appropriate.
Yeah, until your child says they want to be in the picture.
I can see that coming for sure.
Okay. Other than the United States, favorite country where you've been based? I see you've worked all over the world, Thailand, Japan, Mexico. What's your favorite place?
Gosh, I honestly don't want to be lame, but I get so much out everywhere I go. I lived in Bangkok for almost 2 years. And so I would say there, because the depth of friends that I built, the amount of the culture I was able to consume, I spoke the language. Now, this was back in 2004 and 2005. So for a while, I could actually speak some Thai and get away with it. So I just think it's a beautiful country. They're wonderful people and the food's awesome. I mean, it's hard to go wrong there.
And final question, what advice do you have for other manufacturers? For example, the automotive industry which we discussed, as they invest in solutions as a service?
When I think about, I already talked about the need to, or how it's easier if you can create linkages to real value creation. So I won't cover that again. But the second thing I'd maybe say is investing in the infrastructure to make subscriptions work. Everything from investing in a license management platform so that you can manage offers and create bespoke, customized offers for customers. That's a big difference. Everything you and I talked about, Robbie, in terms of the internal change management, practically, but also culturally to what it means. I think I would group that all under sort of the infrastructure to make subscriptions work. And that's a place that if I were embarking on this journey again, I would put even more time and attention earlier.
Justin Rose, thank you so much for being a guest on Subscription Stories. It's been a real pleasure to have you here.
It's been a pleasure to join you. I hope you have a great rest of your day.
That was Justin Rose, the president of Lifecycle Solutions, Supply Management and Customer Success at John Deere. For more about Justin and John Deere, go to deere.com. And for more about Subscription Stories, as well as a transcript of my conversation with Justin, go to robbiekelmanbaxter.com/podcast. Also, I've got a favor to ask. If you like what you heard, please take a minute to go over to Apple Podcasts or Apple iTunes and leave a review. Mention Justin in this episode if you especially enjoyed it. Reviews are how listeners find our podcast, and we appreciate each one. Thanks for your support, and thanks for listening to Subscription Stories.